Welcome to week four of stories about, hearing stories about Swamiji. So we've had a lot of fun these last 3 weeks, just sort of reminiscing a little from the eyes of David Gammell's witnessing different things with Swamiji, a little bit with Karen, a little bit from what I've seen, and this week I get to tell more. I realized when I went home, you know, this has been such a great class because I've thought, oh, this reminds me of that time, and then Swamiji was there, and then that was happening, and I know Asha's working on a history of Ananda right now based on Swamiji's life, and so we'll get to be seeing a lot about how they come together year by year, what he was doing, what Ananda was doing, and that'll be great. So just keeping the energy going in that way. So I've just been launching in. It's been a little bit as it flows, you know, in the moment. I have some topics here, and I'll just dive in. And I think tonight, if you all have something you'd like to ask or something comes up, do that, because that could also prompt some more stories. So I'll have a time when that happens. First of all, I was remembering a story. This was early on when I went to, when I was living at Ananda Village. And as I mentioned in one of the earlier classes, I had been trained as a massage therapist, so I was working on Swamiji with his hip and his back and his neck and his feet. And I would come at the end of my day working at Crystal Clarity, which we called the, with great laughter, Swami's Karma Mill, because in that high energy, everybody's stuff came up really big. It's like any experience in spiritual community is. Whatever faults we have, somebody, you know, nigs us a little and it comes out and we see it and we get to face it and work on it, which is part of the blessing of spiritual community, though not always the most comfortable part. I remember somebody once said, oh, good, you can live at Ananda Village. That's wonderful. That's where everybody gets to rub their rough edges off. And I thought, ooh, that sounds like a horrible reason to go someplace. I don't think I want to do that. But certainly we want to change, we want to grow. Some of us do it more, you know, in our meditations is where it really hits us and we really battle and we really make our commitment to change. And others of us get it by the elbows, you know, and it comes in a combination of things and all of them are good because if anything hurts, as one of the great saints once said, what suffers? Meaning if you have no ego, there is no suffering. So if there's suffering, then something's going on again. Maybe we can adjust a little bit and get free from that. So I came in to see Swamiji at the end of the day, and something had gone wrong at work. I was pretty new. My karma was coming up pretty quickly, you know, so I would have my own reactions to it, being upset or my feelings hurt or whatever it was that was going on. This particular day, there was something that I thought was a real thing. You know, I really had a good reason to be upset, and I thought, well, maybe I'll take it to Swami. Maybe he can give me some, you know, some advice on this. So I started to say, he said, how are you today? And usually it was like, fine, sir, and then, you know, I would start into the treatment, because he'd already had a long day, and, you know, I was just there to, you know, hopefully be an instrument for giving him energy and not, you know, having him have to deal with one more person or one more situation. So, so I usually didn't say much. But this day I said, well, actually, sir, you know, at work there was this really, it was this really hard thing going on. And he just said, he looked at me, just stopped right there. He looked at me, he said, living for God is martyrdom. You know, so I had something to think about for a while. Thank you very much, sir. Go back into that.
What do you say in response to
that? Well, actually, it was perfect because as a child, I'd always read about the saints and heard about the saints from school, and I wanted to be like a saint, and I knew they were martyrs. So I used to think it was a shortcut. You just become a martyr, you die, and you get to be a saint. You know, it was like, okay, so I wanted to be a martyr till I got older and I realized, you know, it doesn't really work that way. And but I had read enough of the teachings already to know that actually it was talking about martyrdom of the ego, was talking about. And then I read a little bit more, you know, what is a martyr? How do they keep that freedom while they're being burnt at the stake or whatever? And there's a part of that that's described as being able to be a witness, just witnessing what's going on. So, you know, in the Christian tradition, as a child, in the cartoon variety, I was thinking, oh, they get burned at the stake, they get their heads cut off, oh boy, that's martyrdom, and then they go to heaven. you know, and it was a lot more subtle because you get a head cut off, you still have your ego. You go to your next life, you know, nothing really has changed. So the real, you know, transcendence, freedom that we aim for, because we want the freedom the martyrs have. We want the, like St. Francis leaning up on the tree as he was just getting ready to die and singing to God out of the great joy, even though his body was racked with all kinds of disease and pain. That kind of, we want the freedom of martyrdom. We don't necessarily want the burning at the stake. But so it was a good thing to say to me, because I did want to be a martyr, and I did know. He was just reminding me, you know, if you're having a hard time, if people hurt your feelings or you think this or that, it's probably your ego. Probably has something to do with your ego. Mm-hmm. So it was a good reminder. There was one time when I was going through very, very heavy duty karma time, probably one of the top two of my life. And it involved a lot of other people, and feelings were being hurt, and that was the hardest thing for me, to think that I was being an instrument and someone else feeling uncomfortable, and I was in the middle of it all. And I was talking to Swamiji, and, you know, by way of sort of unspoken, but really hoping he would give me some advice. And he looked at me and he said, "Think of others. Think of others." So I had, you know, a little thread to kind of carry me through. Think of others. And over the years, I found that if I'm starting to get, you know, kind of too tightly wound around my own situation, thoughts, ego, reactions, think of others, you know. And it's, I think, one of the reasons I took on healing prayers as, you know, kind of a natural way to do it. But anytime I would feel in myself upset, in pain, whatever it was that was going on, if I just would pray for others, I would also kind of feel Swami's blessing in saying, "Think of others." It's like, I'm thinking of others now. And then I would just start praying, and I would find that often that whatever it is that I was wrestling with in my own little world, you just could see it wasn't that important. Yeah, Nishikata.
A variation on that theme, sometimes when I've found myself, I perceive myself to have been injured or hurt some way by some other person, and I find fault with them, and I try to resolve it in my mind, and inevitably fail to do it. I found that just switching around and saying, "The heck with all that, I'm just going to take this opportunity to send blessings to this other person, to bless them unconditionally, send my love to them, ask that they be blessed," and usually everything just lifts that way, and I can move on to something else.
Yeah, wonderful advice. Wonderful.
I was going to mention that, what is that, peace and harmony prayer? Mm-hmm. You know, I have tried that, and that is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Because you don't have to talk to anybody. You just say that prayer, and it's great.
Mm-hmm. That was Swami's definition of a minister, is someone who, when things are difficult, thinks of the other person rather than himself.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sweet.
Does anyone have a friend at Xfinity Wi-Fi that we could have stop? Do any of your computers get hijacked from time to time?
What are you talking about?
You'll be going along your merry way, and then all of a sudden it tells you that they want you to join their network. You tell them to go away, and they come back.
No.
It's just a side of life, one of life's little tests.
You want infinity, not infinity.
That's right, we want infinity. It's close. It's very close. I remember there was a fun experience. I was serving, or at least doing my best to serve, in the Ashland Center. It was a very small center in Oregon. And I was working a regular job during the day to pay rent, and then I was helping with the little center that was going on there. And I was pretty new away. It was my first time living away from Ananda, and I didn't have much satsang, and I was really missing all my friends and missing the times I got to spend at Ananda Village. So I would come whenever I could. And I came down, and I think I could, I was like a, I was kind of like an alarm clock. I could go 4 weeks, and then the alarm would start going off. And if I wasn't there by 5 weeks, I just couldn't, you know, be held accountable for my actions. I really still needed to be, you know, kind of on a tether and check in. And it was just about close to a 5 week thing when I finally got down. And Swamiji was working on a book, and I don't remember the title of the book, but the subject he was on was dealing with the eternal now. So he was thinking about it a lot, and that's kind of where his mind was. And he made some time, you know, we went up to visit him for his blessing. And we were just there for a short time, and I think he read maybe what he was doing. But somehow, in that, I'm not sure if I'm how well I'm going to explain it, but in his aura of concentration on the concept of the eternal now, I think he just was going into it. He was kind of in this sort of timeless place. And it was kind of contagious. So he was saying something about the eternal now, and I basically intellectually have no idea what the eternal now is. I mean, it's a nice thought. You know, it means it's always now. Okay, now. But for me, I have to have some kind of experience to really know. I mean, I haven't seen an eternal now. I haven't looked at a picture of an eternal now. I don't have a way to get my hands around an eternal now. But somehow when Swamiji was sitting there talking about it, my consciousness was taken to a place of eternal now. Mm. It was very, very expansive. It reminded me, you know, that how many of you have seen that movie Bagger Vance?
Oh, yeah.
It's
The Legend of Bagger Vance.
They call it Bagger Vance, The Legend of Bagger Vance. Anyway, it's an interesting movie.
It's wonderful.
A little takeoff on the Gita with a storyline.
Bagger Vance is Bhagavan.
Bhagavan.
Oh.
Bhagavan Krishna. And Arjuna.
Arjuna,
J-U-N-A, is the golfer. So he's Arjuna. And his mentor, I don't remember exactly what his name was in the movie, but you know, he's the role of Krishna. So anyway, they're out on the scene. It's a very hard match. The golfer's been wrestling with demons, off in the war, back, post-traumatic stress, alcoholism, having all kinds of things. Wants to get the girl back, wants to do this big golfing tournament. And along comes his teacher, you know, who's going to help him through this thing. So they're out there, and he's been doing well. He hasn't been doing well. He's been doing his best, but he's a little overwhelmed. His demons are getting the best of him. And the teacher comes up and says, "Now I want you to just get in the flow." And, you know, cinematography being what it is, it sort of expands the horizon, and it kind of, things get a little wavy, you know how they do in a time wobble kind of things. And somehow he's just expanded in this state where he can see exactly where the ball's supposed to go. He's in the flow, you know, the athletes that go in the zone. Well, he's in that, and he just kind of, the whole movie sort of indicates almost like a breathless moment where there just is nothing but eternity in front of him, you know, infinity. And he just shoots the ball, and of course it has a remarkable shot. But anyway, I was up at Ananda Village, and Swamiji was in this place, and I got in the car, and I remember riding around the village. It was like, eternal now. It was like a mantra. I just kept saying it. Eternal now. Eternal now. And it was just having an interesting effect on my consciousness. It was just, you know, the corners of it were just kind of stretching out. And it's very hard to explain, but it was quite fun. Being in Swamiji's presence, even now, I mean, I have to say, because, you know, it's too easy to say, he's not in the body anymore, boo-hoo. You know, there's a little bit of that, but there's a saying in the Christian Bible that I always found was interesting, and Swamiji alluded to this phenomenon. Jesus told his disciples when he'd just done something amazing, and then he said, "Greater things than these I do, you shall do, because I go unto the Father." So it was sort of, you know, saying that when he died, the disciples would be able to do a lot more things. He was also probably encouraging them because they were going to be called upon to do some very hard things once Christ left the body. But I often felt that it would be that way when Swamiji left his body, that his consciousness, you know, from Master told him he'd have freedom. So you're talking about a soul that attained freedom, and that's pretty big. And being held in the body, you know, focusing on the ego and all the tasks and the things, you know, was, it's still a very expanded body and consciousness, but without even having to run that degree of ego holding of a body, you know, I think his consciousness has just gotten a lot more free. So,
A lot of people have said he feels they feel that he's more present, distinctly so, shortly after he passed.
I've heard that a lot, and I've heard it a lot as I travel around other centers from people who never met him. Mm-hmm. You know, they never got to be in the same room with him. But after he passed, they thought, well, wait a minute, everybody's making such a big deal. Maybe I'll tune into this guy. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, they really, you know, felt a lot of blessings and upliftment. It's really fun. I remember, I think it's just that something was written in one of Swami's books, but it struck me especially because you get on the path and you're wrestling with your desires and your attachments. You're thinking, I want to be free, so I don't want to have desires and I don't want to have attachments. And, you know, bad desire, bad attachment. You know, and you're sort of trying to figure out how do I get rid of these things? I don't want to anymore. You know, I'm getting rid of you. And somehow this phrase really helped me in a little more subtle way, embrace the journey toward that. Swamiji said, desire is just as much an affirmation of lack as it is a wish for fulfillment. Mm-hmm. Somehow that hit me where I was, I guess, because I didn't want to affirm lack. I knew that wasn't who I was. And I did want to have a wish for fulfillment, but it seems like well, there was a story. I was once coming down from a treatment with Swami, with my husband then, Adananda. And we went upstairs into the kitchen, and we had gone over just, I think, to have tea. And then it led to reading about the latest book and talking, and then I did a treatment. And then it was very late, and we hadn't had any dinner, but we hadn't noticed at all. We had felt no hunger, you know, nothing while we were there. We were fine. But then we went up the stairs, and as soon as we got to Swami's, where the kitchen is in the Crystal Hermitage, there's a big group, a lot of group meals and events and things happen there, and there's a kitchen there. Once we got there, we were starving. We realized we were really hungry. And I knew that because they have so many events there, they often have a couple of packages of crackers and things that, you know, wouldn't really, nobody would really miss, you know, it wouldn't be a problem. So, but I still felt like, I feel kind of funny going into these cabinets because there was a cook in the kitchen and it was her kitchen. She kind of watched for everything, but I was really hungry. So I started to open the cabinet door to see if there was a cracker in there. And all of a sudden, we hadn't heard anything, but Swami walks in the kitchen. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm caught. You know, here I am. I'm stealing crackers from the Christopher kitchen. Oh, my God, this is not a very good thing. And then I was totally floored because he looked at us, and with the greatest love, he said, oh, why didn't you tell me you were hungry? Mm. I wouldn't have wanted you to go hungry. I would have made sure you... And it was like, you felt like crying, you know, because it was so sweet, you know, that he just cared about such a little thing. And, you know. So, you know how the great saints say, sometimes it's just humorous. I think I was a lot like a child or a grandchild for Swamiji in some ways. I remember once he said, I came back from some, you know, all the older adult people were handling all the difficult things, and I always had just little jobs around the edges, you know, answer the phones, do the filing, you know, be nice, you know, whatever. I didn't really have all that much of import. But the great ones want us to see that it really is about consciousness, and that wherever they are, they encourage us to see that we're going to become that. You know, that we really are already that. We just don't really realize it yet. So they're very natural with us, these great souls. And it's a little adjustment sometimes for us. I remember I was having my back was out. I was working for Crystal Clarity, and my back was out in a pretty bad way. But there was the satsang at Swami's house. And so, of course, you know, we all wanted to go. So we went to the satsang, and I think Swamiji maybe asked me early in the evening, how are you? And I said, oh, my back's hurting a little bit, you know, but I'm okay. And as the evening went on, he has, there's a lower and an upper place in the dome living room. If those of you who've been there, there's a piano on the upper place and a chair, and then there's often Swami's chair down there where he sits. Well, that night he was sitting up there right next to the piano in a comfortable chair. And he'd been there, and lots of people are around, and I'm kind of usually pretty happy to be invisible, you know, in crowds and just close my eyes and meditate as Swami was there. But he said, oh, Elizabeth, my name at the time, come over, sit in this chair. I want you to sit in my chair. And I thought, I was so embarrassed. It's like, oh my gosh, this is Swami's chair. And here are all these people watching. Uh-huh. It's like, oh my gosh. But I said, okay, sir, thank you. So I sat in his chair. And as I sat in the chair, I kind of felt somehow he had blessed it, or he had blessed the situation or something, because as I sat in the chair, my back, you know, just kind of adjusted and didn't hurt anymore. Wow. And I thought, he's giving me something here. I can feel there was a reason for that, and I'm glad he did. And then also, you know, just to say, the masters sit in, you know, at the seat of God. We're going to do that one day too. You know, it was just so sweet, so immediate. You know, he just treated people as his friends, you know, not as somebody far away and, you know, to...
He could tune in to what you needed. That was so wonderful.
Yeah, to tune in and then just to quietly, you know, have that energy there, you know, to offer it. And if I'd been too shy, I would have, oh, no, I can't possibly sit in your chair, you know, then I wouldn't have gotten that blessing. So we do have to receive it.
What a great blessing that was.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And, you know, in his early days, if you listen to Swami's talks, he seemed to focus a lot more on his nature growing up as being a person with such a really good mind. He had a lot of jnana. And the way he was from Master, and he was getting the teachings out there, so he was very clear and, I would say, you know, much more jnanic in his approach. And he would talk about the teachings and talk about yoga and how it could work and like that. And as the years went by, and I think even especially as he went through the marriage time with Rosanna, he seemed to have a time where his male and female were much more balancing. Like, he always had that strong will and that strong mind and that, you know, the masculine part was so strong and always had a sensitivity. But it seems like during this time, his heart just sort of opened a whole lot more. He wrote, exact year it was around that time, he wrote Secrets for Women. He'd started the Secrets book. David spoke a little bit about it. He was on the road selling it. It was a big adventure, you know, it was getting out there to everybody as a gift book, secret series. And he did... Do you remember what the first one was?
Oh, there was a ton of them.
There was a ton of them. He had
Secrets for Women, Secrets for Children, Secrets of Getting Along with Others, uh-huh. Secrets of Emotional Healing, uh-huh. Secrets is just like
Secrets of Love, Secrets of Prosperity, of Secrets of Happiness,
Secrets of Friendship,
Secrets of Winning Others. Yeah, it was a real hit. You know, it got the books and therefore, you know, the teachings and the influence out there into gift stores for the first time. So, whew, you know, it was a big deal getting it all out there. So people would say, Swamiji, we need... You know, they'd be on the phone talking to people, and the stores would say, women are the ones who buy these books. You really need to have more books for the women. And Swami's going, I don't know if I want to... Okay, maybe I'll try a Secrets for Women book. You know, and he kind of would laugh, how am I going to write a book, Secrets for Women, when I'm not even a woman? But it's kind of like during that time when we would go over and see him, it was like he was a woman. I mean, he had this... softness, this kind of maternal aura about him. I mean, he just, and then sort of ever after that time, he always seemed to have more heart, you know, expression, I would say. It was always there, but I think he was just expressing it more. And then, those stores, of course, gift stores in the world being what it is, they were saying, we must have a Secrets of Love book. We must have a Secrets of Love. And Swami would just go, oh, no. Right about, you know, everything that the world thinks about love. You know, I love you, you love me, you know. But finally he took it on, and of course it became a wonderful book. But, he was not beyond teasing about the...
There's a little anecdote about connection with his book, Secrets for Women, and that is that after he was finished, someone inquired about how things were or something, but it led Swami to suggest that, you know, he admitted he had sort of identified what it's like to be like a woman, and he had to do that to write this thing, uh-huh. for several days or weeks or whatever it took. And then he editorialed and he said, but boy, it was tough. I don't see how you can possibly live that way.
Right.
He was talking to some woman who he was talking with.
Speaking of the feeling nature, you know, David Gamow mentioned earlier, it's not as if these great souls, you know, these saints and even the masters, come and just live like Teflon away from the world without feeling anything or engaging. You know, they're absolutely present in whatever it is that's going on. Master wept when Gyanamata passed. He wept when his mother died because, you know, they're fully here in this incarnation. When they're doing what they're doing, they're living the life of a divine incarnation but in a human form, so they're living that human part too. And I remember one time it was so instructive to me and, you know, very meaningful. Swamiji was going through a very difficult time, and you know, we'd seen, he had an amazing way of being like Anandamayi Ma, who said, "I am the same." You know, somebody said, "How are you? How was your youth? How was your getting married? How was this?" To every question, she would answer, "I am the same. You know, I was the same. I was born." And, you know, she just was speaking from her soul level, which never changes. And Swamiji was the same through so many things that would have had anyone else that I know or that we know acting, reacting. He was the same. But this one particular time, there was this very thing, you know, hurting his heart. And I took some things over after work to Crystal Clarity, and I looked at him and I said, "You didn't look so well. You didn't look so happy." And I said, "Swamiji, what's the matter?" He said, "Well, I'm struggling with depression," he said. Mm. And always instructive, you know, how honest he was with me just to say that. You know, within a half an hour or so, he was out of it. You know, he was no longer struggling. But the way he put it was really instructive for me, because it's something that I had to deal with from time to time, is, oh, you know, I think I'm depressed, you know, and what do I do about that? And but he actually didn't say, "I am depressed." He was very careful about his words. He said, "I am struggling with, you know, this thing. I am struggling with it." So it helped me so much whenever I would start to think, oh, I am struggling with whatever it is. Mm. It's not I am sick, I'm tired. I am, you know, struggling with this thing, because that's the path, is a lot of it is struggling. It's not all struggling. A lot of it's great joy, great uplifts and comforts and divine consolations, as they're called, good meditations. Like my friend Chidambar, who's such a man of few words. We all in the room know him. And we were somewhere in a workshop or something, and some new people were saying, "Well, I don't know, how do you keep going? And what do you do about this? And it's so hard about that." And Chidambar said, "Well, you go along, and then you have a good meditation." And it was true. A lot of us laughed because, you know, things can get kind of heavy and tough and slogging through, and then something happens. If it's a satsang or a save opportunity or a meditation or singing or something, and then, you know, we just lift it out of it. We just realize. There's something Swami said a lot during these last few years that I've been starting as I get maybe one of the gifts of age. He said, you know, it reaches a point where nothing really matters that much. I mean, it seems like when you're young, things matter so much. I mean, matter in the way that if it doesn't happen, you're really upset, or you're hurt, or you're discouraged, or, you know, your ambitions are thwarted and it really causes you to have a difficult time. So many things along the way that, you know, incarnations, you know, we still have going. But Swamiji just said, you know, you reach a point where it just doesn't matter that much. And I've been starting to see just like glimpses of that now in my 60th year. There's something magic about the 60th year because it's 12 times Jupiter's doing something. I have to have a reading to figure out all the details of it, but I know something's going on. And it's, you know, it's just getting a little more withdrawn. It's, you know, the rollout here is just a little less real than it used to be. And it just doesn't matter as much. Things happen, it just doesn't matter as much. And for Swamiji, mostly at the end, he was just saying so much about bliss. You know, nothing else was mattering, pretty much. He had a way of listening in a very, very deep way to the soul. And when people would come to him, I remember once my mother had just passed, and I was working at Earth Song as a waitress, and that was a very fast-moving, you know, kind of good karma yoga opportunity, working with a lot of energy. And so I was sort of leaning on that because my mother just passed. I went to her funeral, I came right back, and I went right back to work. And I just thought, this is good. Karma yoga works. You know, I will just do this. I will just put all my heart, all my soul, I will just do this, and this will be it. But I was sort of not really dealing with all the parts of my nature that were being affected by my mother's passing. So Swami came into the restaurant for lunch, and he was aware that my mother had passed. And I was, you know, had people with him, and we were serving the table. And then he looks at me and he said, "How are you?" And he said it in a way that was so soul comforting. He really cared. You know, his energy went all the way into those places that I was not wanting to feel because it was going to hurt too much. He just kind of went right into those places with that question, with his energy really first. And the question was sort of laid on top of it. And in answering him, I think I maybe said something like, "Oh, I'm fine, sir," you know, and then he looked at me again because he knew I wasn't really answering the question. And then basically I burst into tears and had to get somebody to take my shift for a while and went in the temple and realized, you know, there were some other places in my heart that, you know, weren't, that I was trying to rush around too much to feel, and I needed to just allow those to be there. He was such an example of even-minded cheerfulness. I think you maybe have all heard this story, but it bears repeating. One of the worst days of the court case, where he'd been in the courtroom for many days, and this particular day he was being cross-examined, you know, by the other guys, and nobody was allowed to be in there with him. I don't remember how the other guys got away with that, but everybody had to be gone. So we were all out in the hall. Usually many people could be in there, and at least they could be, you know, kind of praying with them or giving him energy in some way. But everybody had to be outside. And from time to time, you know, the room was really kind of tense because his heart was, you know, very weak at that time, and there was a concern that if too much pressure was put on, he could have a physical problem, plus the fact that people were just being so rotten in there and being so mean and nasty, that we didn't want him to have to go through that. Certainly we would want some of us to be in there, but that was not so. So we were sitting outside and kind of being a little bit nervous and tense and wondering how he was doing. And I remember several people had brought their, you know, the kind of reading that you do to just let your mind be light, you know, take your mind off the situation. People were reading mystery novels. Several people had their latest mystery novel they were reading. So they're reading the mystery novel like this, and somebody was doing the crossword. And after a while, Davey took a bunch of us. We went in the room and did some affirmations, which were really good. And I had come that day, and for some reason I was also feeling, you know, I also had to testify in that room with those people, and I was kind of nervous. So I had taken the little baby Gita with me, and I was just opening it and reading, you know, a line here and a line there. I'm reading my little Gita, just trying to draw in, you know, Krishna's blessings and calmness and, you know, praying for Swamiji at the same time. And the other people are doing their mystery novels. And Devi comes by and she looks at my little Gita and she says, "Oh, that's a good one. For that one, God is the doer. He's the one who done it." All the other ones were who done it. So we got a little laughter. But then Swami came out after being grueling. And from time to time, we'd slip over and look. There was a little tiny piece of glass on the wooden door, and we'd kind of look in and make sure he was still okay in there. And so the door opens, and he comes out. We all come and, you know, stand around him. "Swamiji, how are you? How are you?" And he said, "I'm stirred, not shaken." And I think he borrowed a James Bond line, and we all broke into laughter. You know, it just broke the tension. But for him, you know, he could even find that cheerfulness and that humor in the midst of, you know, a really bad situation. I remember one time I went, it's funny the things we remember, because usually when you really need help, that's when you ask for it. And sometimes those are the things that we remember. So another time I was in some kind of karmic pickle and I saw him and was a little upset and not talking about it a lot or anything. But right before I left, he looked at me and he said, "Now be of good cheer." You know, and that was another one that kind of I hung on to. Be of good cheer. Be of good cheer. Okay. Be of good cheer. He certainly was a person of good cheer. There was when Biraj and I got married, we had a little money for a honeymoon, and we Swami had been in Italy for a long time and we were really missing him, so we thought, well, we've been given this little bit of money, so maybe there's a place Swami would like to go to rest and relax. You know, we could offer to take him to that place. And so we wrote, and we didn't hear back, and then and then we made other plans, you know, to just go. And then right like a week before, we got a news from Lakshman, his secretary, who said, "Didn't you get the email? You know, aren't you going to go with Swami somewhere?" And it was like, wow, yeah, sure. So, you know, we made it all up. And what Swami really liked to do was go to Lake Lugano, which is just in Switzerland. It's a sweet little town. It's kind of like a Carmel on a beautiful lake. But Switzerland, and maybe even more like Rodeo Drive or something. I mean, it had these little walkways. Swami would get a walk in, and we would walk with him. And we were walking, and I remember walking down this little narrow road, just a pedestrian thing, and there were all these shops. And the shops there, because it's Swiss, and people come with their big Swiss bank accounts, I guess. They have a lot of money to spend. Something happens. Anyway, they had the best of everything there. You know, they had the Rolex watches and the diamond, you know, all these things on either side, you know, just in the windows, beautifully displayed, you know, just like the highest of the material world, you know, that has to offer, you know, just all these things. And we're walking along with Swamiji, and I remember looking to this side and seeing, you know, the amazing, beautiful window with the diamonds, and the side had some other amazing material, high-level thing. And I remember walking along with Swamiji, and it seemed like we were just with him in this aura of light, you know, just walking along. And the phrase, "There's nothing here nearly so dear," you know, nearly so dear. All that, you know, the world can have all of that, because here we are with Swamiji, and we are just so, none of those things could come close to the happiness that we feel just being in this aura of just expansive love and joy and, you know, divine friendship. The images.
What a contrast, huh?
It was that. It was, you know, the real contrast. Here's a Swami walking down the middle, you know, Swami who could go anywhere and did go anywhere, He didn't stay away from the material world and, you know, cast away all of that stuff. He just walked wherever he was in that freedom and
well,
that joy.
The story from the AY where Master Mahashaya said, he gave away his fortune. He denied his inheritance. He said, I've given away a few paltry rupees for a kingdom of eternal bliss.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who is the true renunciate?
Who is the true renunciate? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was just fun to have that sort of played out on the stage. One time I was with Swamiji, and I think it was the time after I had recovered from surgery, and I think I was a little bit thinner. You know, the veil between my body and my soul maybe was a little thinner because I'd just come back from, you know, hours in surgery, and my little spirit was probably soaring around up there, not so much in the body. So it was all just kind of I was a little less on the earth, you know, for a little while. And Swamiji came into the room, and, you know, I just felt such gratitude. It just swept over me, and just for all the things he'd given me, for the meditations that I'd had, for the life of service, you know, for the friendship, just all of it sort of swept over me, and it kind of, you know, almost overcame me. And I think it was all coming out of my eyes. You know, most of what I could do is just pranam, you know, and just look at him. And he looked at me and sort of, you know, could size up what was going on there. And he just looked at me and he said, well, don't stop here. Go all the way to God. Don't think it's this. I mean, you know, we all knew we were trained, you know, it isn't Swamiji, it's the consciousness that's moving through him. But he always wanted to be sure we would remember that and not get confused. During that same time when we were, I was recovering from the surgery, it was winter time, and so he had a place in the sunroom where he let my husband and I come and stay because I needed to walk, and where I lived didn't have any walking space, and it was too cold to go outside, so he invited us to stay there. And he also was recovering from something. And he had to walk. His doctor said he had to walk. So I had to walk and he had to walk. So we would take these trips. He would come up the stairs and then we'd meet in the sunroom, and then we would take a big hike. Those of you who've been to the Crystal Hermitage, we'd go all the way around the living room. We'd go up the little stairs. We'd go all the way around the kitchen. That would be a lap. And then we'd come down and we'd do it again and do it again. So he'd have to do a certain number. And he always counted his laps, you know, to make sure he was doing the right number. And sometimes he would sit down and rest a little bit. And one time we were walking along, and here I was having this great time with Swamiji. I didn't care that, you know, I just came from a surgery, but here we were just walking along, having the best time. You know, this is lovely, Swamiji. Laughing, and then I thought, oh my gosh, here I am, and all my workmates are on this big deadline, and I'm not there, you know, and they're doing so much more because I'm not there. And, you know, I started feeling really guilty. And Swamiji looked at me and he said, what's the matter? I said, oh, Swamiji, you know, I'm here and they're doing it. I just feel so useless. He looked at me and he said, well, you are useless. It was important for me, though. It wasn't just a joke because you know, I always think you have to be, I mean, I have a tendency to think you have to be serving, you have to be getting things done, you have to be productive, you know, you have to be making something, you know, happen for Master in order to be a good disciple. And there I was, you know, totally useless. It was just, so what? It doesn't really matter. You know, so what? Do you love God? You know, are you happy? Do you love God? Are you doing what you can? You know? So it kind of broke that. Merrily along, I was working at Crystal Clarity, and then things changed in the market. I was with the metaphysical bookstore side. That was going away, and there needed to be changes and downsizing, and financial things were going on, and community karma things were going on. All of that led to me being let go of Crystal Clarity. And I think I've never been fired before. The first time I'd ever been fired from anything. So it not only meant I was fired for the first time, but it meant that...
Well, that's not being fired. That's being laid off. That is
different. Yeah. Right. A fine distinction. It's true. I hadn't blown it and they were kicking me out on my ear, but, you know, I was without a job and without an income and I didn't know how I was going to be able to stay at the community and such. So it was kind of important to me. But I was feeling a little kind of badly, not sure what was going to happen. And started feeling a little low about it, and I went up to see Swamiji, and he said, well, how are you doing? You know, and the way he said it was like, okay, it's a test, isn't it? You know, and I thought, okay, it's a test. I'm going to sort of wring my spine. I said, well, I am a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, and I'll be fine. And then it was kind of like, who said that? But he kind of drew that out of me. I mean, this is a test. You know, what do you do with that? And who are you in reality? You know, and I couldn't say I'm free spirit. You know, I'm going off into self-realization. But at least I could say, darn it, I'm a disciple. And I'm going to be a disciple. And whatever else happens.
He must have drawn that out of you. Because I don't picture you saying that.
That's
so what did happen, if I may ask?
Oh, well, then I moved to Portland and worked at the bookstore and, you know, went on and had other adventures. And,
yeah, so you did.
And I'm still
good
a disciple. Oh, there's another funny one. I don't know, I have the kind of nature that sometimes if I'm in a situation, I'll kind of absorb some of the karma of it somehow. I mean, I'm sensitive. Those of you who are sensitive know what I mean, you know, mm-hmm. sort of like a pain. But, you know, sometimes it's useful. I mean, in meditation it's useful, and attunement it can be useful, but in day-to-day living it can make it a little bit rough sometimes. So in the middle of everybody's karmic thing, sometimes I would just feel like, oh, I have to find a way to help them solve it, or there must be something we could do, and I would sort of just get, you know, unsettled about it and worried about it is what I would do. Not very useful being worried, but I would get that way. So something had happened at work, and then I was seeing Swamiji, and he said, so, how are you doing? You know, you seem to be a little troubled. And I said, oh, Swamiji, you know, so-and-so's this or so-and-so's that, and that's not happening, and they're not happy, or whatever it was. And he said, oh, don't you worry your pretty little head about it.
Oh, that's cute.
And actually, it was very sweet. I mean, there was a part of me that, you know, had been trained. I grew up, you know, in the 70s where I was reading Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan, and I was reading the feminists, and I was, you know, women are just as good as men, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's not the kind of thing, you know, you would say to a feminist. But I, there was only a little part of me that was that. And so I just kind of went, oh, never mind. I'm just going to enjoy it, you know. And so from time to time, I just remember, you know, I start getting into worrying, and I go, don't you worry your pretty little head. My goodness, where are you doing anyway?
It's so funny, these stories you've been telling tonight, that it's just this theme of, like, he's very amazingly tuned into just the right nuance of phraseology, mm-hmm. for that specific person and what they, you know, they need to hear or could hear.
He was so appropriate to every person. I remember we were... We went on a pilgrimage to the shrines in Southern California. It was 80-something, and there was a big group, went in a couple of buses, and stayed at a big hotel, and all of us in our rooms. And we had a day of, you know, we saw Encinitas, we did the crypt. It was a wonderful pilgrimage.
Went to Disneyland.
Remember?
Yeah. Swami loved Disneyland.
Yeah, it was great fun. Sort of like, where's Swami in Disneyland? There somewhere.
That was great fun.
And then there was a discipleship. And so we had kind of a day of seclusion. So it was a more inward, you know, really serious focused things. And we were doing it. I don't remember the exact date, but somehow Swami was making reference in the talk. It was a very deep talk for him about the discipleship to when Master left the body. We had just visited
the Biltmore. The blessing was in the Biltmore.
Was it?
Yeah. I have a photo.
That happened in 93. I don't know if you're talking about the thing
earlier.
This was earlier. I think it was in a special room in the Sanderling Hotel. We had a special room for the discipleship. You know. But somehow he was getting into that theme. And anyway, it was a very deep, you know, we had all been on pilgrimage, so everything was left behind. We'd been steeping ourselves in all the great shrine places and meditating a lot and chanting, and, you know, we were just this tight little group, and we kept going deeper and deeper, and then the seclusion day happened, and then here we are in this room. We're going to take this, renew our discipleship with Swamiji. And so we go through the ceremony. He tells a moving story about being with Master and Master leaving his body. And, you know, Swamiji could barely speak. He was so moved and it was so immediate and present. We were just with Swami and with Master in this deep, deep, deep way. And then Swamiji blessed everyone in the room. Deep blessings. Later he said, that was a challenge for me. I had to keep my attention at the point between my eyebrows the whole time. I think he said it more as a lesson than as a real test for him. But so that was a deep, deep, deep time. And the door opened, we were finished, and we opened our eyes. We're just so, you know, together in the spirit. And in comes somebody who'd heard about this pilgrimage from a friend, somehow scoped out that we were here at this time. Brand new person, maybe had been to a service at Ananda once or something, had all these questions. Comes kind of barreling in with just this big energy of, wow, this is fun. Who are you? What are you doing? Where are you from? And, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, whoa, that's another reality. You know, here we are, just in this deep, deep, deep silence. And then here's this new person, you know, the very, very new person coming in. And I was so impressed because he walked up to Swami and just asked some really first-person simple question, like, who was Yogananda, or something like that. And Swamiji just didn't miss a beat. He just brought that consciousness, we were, you know, all the way down, very gently, and just answered that person's questions, just without any obvious gear shifting, you know. I would have been screeching, you know, if my gears were trying to ratchet down even from where I was. But he just was so appropriate. He just wasn't about his being in this great, you know, state with all these devotees. It was, oh, this is what's happening now. There's a new person. They're interested in Master. Isn't that good? You know, he just, you know, full-heartedly, you know, embraced them. And he was really fun in restaurants, so he would always engage the waiter or the waitress and give them energy. Thank you for serving us. Oh, where are you from? And if they were from Italy, he'd talk to them in Italian. And if they were from Germany, maybe he'd say a few German words. You know, or Indian, if they were Indian, he would say something. What city are you from? So I try and remember to do that, you know, just to include that. Because we would often be at the table with him and, you know, it's just such a lovely bubble. And he just wouldn't hold that bubble. He would just, somebody comes along, he just includes them. You know, oh, yes, welcome.
I had a lovely chat there with one of the front desk people at the hotel. Because we were in the Biltmore, and that's where the last smile picture was taken when Master passed away. And you could see right where it was. And people, we were all in there, we were all taking photos, and this guy kept wondering what the heck. Some wall.
Yeah.
Takes a picture of a wall. And he said, and so I chatted with him, and he said, once in a while, other people would come through the hotel and they would take pictures of the wall. Yeah. So we had a long talk about Master, and I gave him an AY.
Oh,
I don't know if anything ever happened.
Sweet.
But it was sweet. Mm.
Yeah,
he
never
spoke of
the wall the same way after that.
No, he said, oh, thank you so much. And these people walk and take pictures of the wall. He never could figure out what.
Of course, it would seem strange, yeah?
Yeah, of course.
During one of those, I don't know if it was the one that we had in 93 and we had a discipleship initiation then, it was in the Biltmore, and I had just discovered the lobby, which was where the dining room was.
Right.
And it was a pretty special place to sit. So we had an opportunity to go in there in spare time or whatever, to go in and sit down in there. And this particular time, the Los Angeles Marathon was happening. At the same time. And so every once in a while, these people would run through in full running gear. They'd come in, they'd do some kind of inane business with somebody, they'd drink some water, and then go running out. It just struck me that we were occupying the same space, and the perception was so dramatically different.
That's interesting.
That's funny.
Well, David's going to give us 10 minutes of a close-up, and so for the next 5 minutes, I have one little exercise. Our eyes.
little visualization. So throughout these weeks, we've heard many things that Swami has said, things we've seen. This consciousness is alive right here, right now. And just to help bring it more alive, I thought it would be fun to just do a visualization, imagining that you're there with Swamiji, he's sitting in a chair, standing. And each of us come up to him for his blessing. And with his blessing, he gives us one of these little phrases, like he used to give. Some of the ones we've heard, put more energy into you, or don't worry your pretty little head about it. Don't stop here, go all the way to God. Be of good cheer. Or any perfect one that he would choose for your soul, for where you are now, or how you would like to grow, how you would like to get closer to God. Let's take a moment to tune in your heart, to open your heart. And then mentally walk up to Swamiji, stand or kneel before him, and listen to him as he gives his blessing in words for your next step. He might say your name, then give you the thought. He would often say things like, I would like you to, or I would like to see you do this or that. And for the second part of the blessing in the wordless place of energy, gaze up at the point between the eyebrows and receive the touch from Swamiji of his blessing at our spiritual eye. And relax your energy in the spine, keeping it uplifted, tuning into the consciousness of Swamiji, of Master through Swamiji. And now, as we naturally would, we pranam. In gratitude, appreciation. The light of God that has come through the Masters, Swamiji, all of our divine friendships.
Just a few things there. A couple of thoughts occurred to me as I was thinking about tonight. One is our relationship with Swami, that he was asked often over the years. People wanted to put him on the altar, and of course he didn't want that. And how do we relate to you? And he always said, I'm your friend. And over the more recent years, I really began to feel more of the depth of that and what he was really saying, at least as far as I could understand. He had said in the past that friendship is the purest form of relationship because there's no compulsion in it. If it's a family member, well, there you are. There's nothing you can do about it. Even if it's a spouse, there's a certain level. Compulsion may be a little strong, but you know what I mean. I mean, there's expectation. But friendship is just completely freely given. It's a friend, and sometimes you drift away from your friends, and sometimes you don't. So it's this completely free offering. And the second level of it is, he just wanted to help us. And it came from that level of compassion, where it's as if we were all in a prison, which we really are. On some level, the material world is just a prison. It's a prison constructed by our own minds, but we're stuck here. And there's this compassionate person who wants to help us get out. And it's really the best way to look at it, because there's a little bit of a tendency, and we all have it to some degree, to look at Swami as other. As, well, he's Swami, and he's a little distant. And when I would watch people around him who were around a little longer, let's say, and they would sometimes almost tie themselves up in knots, being around him, like, I want to say, that's not helpful. He's our friend, and he really is our friend, and it's not more than that. So the more we can relax into that relationship, and really relax. Swami also spoke about not working so hard in meditation. Meditation is about relaxing. And if we can bring that kind of understanding into our relationship with him, he can enter much more easily and much more completely. So it's a combination of very deep respect, but for a friend, and relaxing and allowing that to come in. And so I'm hoping through over the last 4 weeks, through the different stories we told, the times he was joking and fooling around, and it gave a little broader perspective. I think it's why Swami put in the path, Master would play with the little spark gun and he would send up the little man in the parachute, because he wanted to make Master human enough, which can be lost in other people's interpretation of Master. He's Paramahansa Yogananda, the great avatar who's responsible for the universe. Well, that's fine, but we need to get in there somehow. And that seems a little intimidating to me. And we need to make sure that we don't do that with Swami. We don't want to put him on that mental pedestal. The respect is there, the accomplishments spiritually that he's done are there, but we need to leave it soft enough that he's just our friend. He may be a friend who's taller and stronger than we are, but he's just our friend. So I sort of wanted to share that, to try and bring the energy in, you know, and focus that. The other part that occurred to me, and this is a little tricky to describe, so I will do my best. It feels to me that it's not about willpower. We try and do the right thing. And I have, I'm sure everyone does, and I have these little notes that I stick all over my walls and on my computer about, you know, don't do this, and see God in everyone, and don't forget to do this, and remember to do this, and you know what I mean, all those little things. And that's fine. It's not that those are not good, but they're not the point, and there's like a break point. That is, you can stack up lots of those, and it doesn't get you through a certain ceiling. And that ceiling, as I was thinking about this, is the right attitude. For example, Swami didn't really notice people's age. If it was relevant, he would notice, if that was the topic of discussion and it mattered, but he didn't relate to you as a certain age. If you remember, Asha has spoken during Sunday service, not once in her 40 years with him did he ever make her feel like, well, I've been doing this a lot longer than you. And it's not that he had to remember. He didn't have post-its on his computer reminding him age isn't important. It's that he didn't see the world that way. And I feel that to a degree, at least, as devotees, we need to see the world the way Master saw the world. And it's not about remembering all these, you know, don't be judgmental, don't do this, don't do that. Those things are crucial, of course. But we want to remember those things and do those things so we get to the point where our attitude changes. And Swami spoke about the difference between a good attitude and the right attitude. A good attitude is doing your best. I have a good attitude. You know, even if I'm tired, I make sure to X. The right attitude is seeing the world the right way. You don't even feel tired. You see the difference? He didn't have to remember not to be conscious of people's age because he didn't see it. And so what we want to do is we want to develop in the way, what I found most inspiring about him, in a sense, shouldn't say most inspiring, but you'll see what I mean, was that. I never felt the effort of it all. And for me, it feels like an effort. Like my energy gets down and I have to remember to pick it up, and then you energize. And those things are good. I'm not at all saying they're not good. But with him, it was so graceful because it's simply how he saw the world. And it's almost that aha experience. Like Master said, if you could only see yourselves as I see you. So that was the other part that occurred to me. That's the goal. Like when he said to Lahari, don't stop there. You know, he said in the raise reading,
oh, people think a saint is just someone who sort of is nice all the time, which is just slightly improving your current mess of pottage, is the way he put it. We want more than that. We need to get that attitude change so that we really see God as the door. And for me, that's why I was so inspired. I was blessed to spend a fair amount of time with him over many, many years. And I just never saw the effort of it. And to me, that was really incredible. He just got it. And he could show some frustration sometimes, but I never felt that in the core, anything had changed. So I wanted to share those, if that's at all helpful, in sort of taking these hundreds of stories that we've heard and weaving them into a tapestry to bring one thing out of the class. So I hope it's been a lot of fun. It's really, I know I've spoken with Lahari. It's been an incredible blessing for us to be able to share these things in so many different ways.
It's been so much fun.
I'm glad.
And I listen to, you know, I told you I like to listen to class. I have listened to 2.5 now. It's
2.5 of the weeks.
Yeah.
Already? Oh, good.
It's just great.
I'm glad the recordings came in.
Oh, very nicely. Very
good, nice. Wonderful.
And you said they're going to be posted anyway.
Yeah, I think that we're going to put them up on paloalto.org.
I got them. If you want to, don't want to wait, you can contact Vinny.
Well, now that the fourth one's done, it should go up. It should go up quickly.
Yeah, I think that would be great.
But you know, I'll ask almost everyone, we need to do this. You know, we know Master because of all the stories that Swami has shared over the years.
Helps.
We never met Master. So, in a sense, it's almost an obligation on our part to just share our experiences with Swami because we want to keep that energy as present as possible
that's
all the
really
time.
Yeah.
So, you know, the more we can do that. And thank you for being here and the wonderful excuse for me to dig out all these old stories I haven't thought about in years.
Well, I want to commend both of you, as I said to you the other day, that you shared a lot of stuff that a lot of people wouldn't be willing to do. They wouldn't because they didn't want people to know about all this.
Well, I mean,
I think it's great.
You remember that wonderful story? A man had come to counsel with Swami when Asha was Swami's secretary. So she was sitting there, and it was something, you know, significant and personal. And so Asha stood up to excuse herself, and the man was Indian and looked at Asha and said, "Where are you going?" And she said, "Well, I wanted to give you some privacy." And he said, "How could there possibly be secrets between gurubais?"
Yeah, that was very sweet.
We're here to find God. What's to hide? Who are you fooling?
No, you're right. Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I want to be corrected. I would rather have Swami strike me on the head than not think of me.
But I also mean that you've been willing to share it with everybody.
But again,
I
mean, you know.
It's an example. Good example.
Well, if anyone started the series here thinking that I didn't have flaws and that they weren't obvious, you've now been disabused of that notion. So.
Anyway. That's great.
Well, thanks. It's nine.
Thank you.
Yeah, really our joy. Thanks for coming.
Great fun.